Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode number 57 for July 2015. Hey guys, it's Patrick. We're back after a month out. I was on holiday and trying super hard not to record anything for a couple of weeks. And I really wanted to record a Phileas Club, but then I stood on my principles that holidays had to be holidays, and I didn't. So I'm very proud of myself, but I'm also incredibly happy to be back because I'm telling you, talking about the world news, which is what we do here, in such a laid-back and cool and friendly environment with people from all over the world is really something I've missed. Thankfully, we have an excellent panel to bring us back, starting with, of course, Mr. Turkey from Saudi Arabia. How's it going, Mr. Turkey? And he's silent now. He's silent just to annoy me.
I'm here.
You are. Excellent. So yeah. How have you been doing? I missed you. Great. 2 months without you. I was lonely.
Yeah, you were lonely. I saw the photos you were posting. You weren't lonely at all, man.
Yeah, we had a lovely vacation with my wife and some friends in Finland, where nature is absolutely amazing. It was a bit cold, but it was wonderful. And thank you for being back on the show. I'm looking forward to hearing all of the mean things you have to say about everyone.
Sure. I look forward to that. I haven't been mean for a while.
Returning guests also from, let's start with an old timer that we haven't heard from in a while, Paul from Hong Kong. How's it going, Paul?
Hi, it's going great. How are you doing, sir? It's been a while. Glad to be back for sure.
Very happy to have you on. What time is it for you? It's 4 p.m. for me.
Yeah, it's right now it's like 10:10 p.m. Hong Kong time.
Okay, that's not too bad. Every time, I don't know, for some reason, I think the difference, I equate, you know, the entirety of Asia to the US of the other side of the world. So I usually assume that the time differences are impossible to deal with. But that's not too bad. That's actually pretty okay. All right. And we also have Matthias from Germany. How's it going, sir?
Hello, Patrick. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you back as well. I think we're going to have some interesting debates about our European brethren from the Mediterranean. And well, you know what? Let's just jump right into it. I'm not sure how much Turkey and Paul are going to have to contribute to this conversation, but I think it's going to be interesting to hear if they even care at all. Once again, Greece has been very much in the news in the past, I would say 2 months, because obviously I'm guessing everyone has heard about the Grexit, as we've coined the term, of the possibility of Greece actually exiting the Eurozone. And if they didn't manage to find an agreement with the rest of Europe because of their insurmountable debt. And I'm not going to go over the entire story. What I'm going to go over is how I think it was reported on in France, which is basically a huge amount of confusion. It was sort of a sandwich between those who were saying, this is ridiculous, and the Greeks have suffered enough, and so they are being oppressed by the evil, European elite. And the banks are basically pressuring people who have already lost everything. And this is no way to treat your fellow human beings. And on the other side, there were very staunch believers of the fact that, you know what? Greece has put itself in this situation themselves. And that is just what happens when you mess up. And so you should face the facts and just pay the money back and you know, reduce your expenses. And that's just the way it's going to be.
I'll vote for that view.
Well, I was pretty certain you would. I have a little bit more to say about this, but I'm curious to hear how it was reported on and how it was felt in Germany, which is, in my impression, leading the charge of that second view.
Kind of, yes, because the monetary aspect of this whole situation is the most important part for the media, apparently. But as with every complex topic, most of the people don't really know what is going on anyway. They just know bits and pieces. And to be fair, it is so complicated. I don't understand it myself completely, so I am one of those people. But again, if you just rely on the media, there has been a lot of media, I would even call it agitation, and well, some false reports as well. So I'm not sure if people in Germany or the average Joe on the street, so to speak, really has a complete picture and could make an informed decision about that. But you're right, most of the people say, well, they have to get out themselves. So
yeah, Germany, you yes. owe money, you pay it. That yes. is not a German accent at all, I apologize.
Provide a German accent, so there's no problem.
Thanks. But yeah, I think it's very fair that what you were saying, that people don't understand it, and me either. That's actually what I was going for initially before I explained the two sides of the sandwich, which is no one understands it. No one really knows what the hell is happening and what the real problem is and how to really fix it. Everyone is going from almost admittedly gut reactions. And everyone, you know, when you boil down the a country's economy to a simple concept, basically people bring it to their level and think, well, if I incur debt,
why
then
are you
I have to pay for
things,
it.
Patrick, why are you complicating things? They screwed up and they're paying for it. End of story.
Well, so that's the thing. I think when you listen to anyone who is an expert in that situation, there are a couple of factors which, you know, again, that I've heard, and that the most mind-boggling thing is that this is being reported as such, not in disbelief, but okay, let me tell you what people say. What we're doing now, the agreement that was agreed on, is basically the same thing we've been doing for 2 or 3 years. And it has not yielded results. And by everyone's account, it is not going to be yielding results in the future either. The only way out of this crisis, which could potentially affect the Eurozone in its entirety and the world in its entirety, again, according to the experts, or many of the experts that I've heard, people who know what they're talking about, the only way to get out of it is to actually forgive the debt. It's the only way that Greece can recover. You know, there have been a lot of parallels made with post-war Europe and the way that Germany, you know, ironically, Germany, France, and many other countries were basically received a huge amount of money that they never paid back. And it's very hypocritical. You know, a lot of people have been making that parallel and saying it's somewhat hypocritical to now be demanding that Greece, which is, you know, yes, they put themselves in this situation. It's kind of like the too big to fail situation. The banks that were at the origin of the financial crisis from a few years ago were responsible for that themselves. Yet it was such a big, you know, it was such a big deal and it affected so many economies that they just had to be bailed out. And it's kind of the same situation here in Greece. Or, you know, again, no, that's no, no, what no, people are saying, not except
that's
people
very
are
much
not.
Different. That's very much different.
Okay.
You can't, when my bank fails in my own country and I pay from my tax money to save it, so to save the economy of my own country, that's my money I'm paying to save my country. Greece is not my country. Why would I pay for it? I'm talking as a European. Let's assume I'm European. Why would I pay to save Greece when Greece itself screwed up from day one when they lied to get to be part of the European currency?
Because
they
have a million people sitting down there and don't know what to do, can't get to their money, can't make a living and stuff like that. That is not just a too big to fail issue. Like, it's a bank. There are actual people down there who need help. That's the issue, not the too big to fail.
And if you know Greek people, no offense, I'm not trying to offend the Greek people here.
let's just insult everyone in Greece.
I really don't care. I know Greek people. I've met the Greek people here in Saudi and abroad, and there are different types of people. But overall, the Greek population rely too much on the government and government jobs. They rely on government jobs to the point that there are actually, I know for a fact of one project that has been paying salaries for people in Greek government jobs that they stay at home and do nothing because the project ended in the first year, yet the contract was for 5 years.
You know, I don't think that's in question. I think, and we've been talking about this on the show even a couple of times, I think everyone agrees that the reason why Greece is in this situation is because not only these kinds of shenanigans, but also the Greek people are at fault. You know, they don't. A lot of them are not paying their taxes. They're skimming on the side. They're being paid in cash. All of that, but. The reality of the situation is now they are in big trouble, and the what Matthias was talking about, which is they actually need help, is one factor. But even if you want to be selfish in this, what we're doing now, giving them more money and hoping that by some kind of magical sleight of hand they're going to be able to pay us back the enormous amount of money that they owe us, is not realistic. We've been trying it for years, and it's just kicking the problem down the line.
Because they need money, Patrick. It's not that they need money. It's not about money. They need to restructure their entire system. The way they give out jobs for people, the way they do contracts, the way they do, the entire system needs to be fixed. And when they're sitting there and their current government says, Greece pride, they're not going to fix anything if they're going to keep on saying it's all about their pride and they're protecting their pride. No, fix it. You're the ones who got this into trouble yourselves. Nobody pushed you into it. Nobody forced you into anything.
That's true. But
their rhetoric isn't very helpful in this situation. But again, a country is like a big oil tanker. You can't just turn it around. You need to slowly turn. You can't do it overnight.
And the worst part is, what you're saying, Turkey, is completely true. But if you look at things realistically for a moment, for just, a couple of minutes, they are not going to fix it. And if the situation continues, they could take down a good part of the Eurozone with them. And, some people are saying, they get out of the Eurozone and that's going to be fine. We stay. We included too many countries to begin with. It would be healthy to have Greece and maybe a few others get out and make the entire zone a little bit more stable financially. But that's not, it would still be a cataclysm in terms of economy. And you can say, and it's true, that they put themselves in this situation and that they need to fix it, but it doesn't change the fact that it's not going to happen, in the year that we've given them to do it, right? So it's this kind of impossible situation where your guts, at least that's the way it's being felt in France, your guts is like, well, you shouldn't have messed up with everything. And at the same time, we know that it's not going to get better. So politically, politicians are semi-pandering, saying, they have to pay for it themselves, because that's what people want to hear. And they don't want to hear, well, we have to pay for them. And I understand, I don't want to pay for the Greeks. So I'm not even sure what I would like the situation to become. But anyway, that's why it's so difficult. It's that Turkey, you're right, but it doesn't make
Did you just say I was right? Oh my God.
Damn it.
Thank God this is recorded for history, for prosperity.
All right, Paul, is that even reaching the far shores of Hong Kong?
Yeah, it's something that people are paying close attention to because it's had an impact on the Hang Seng Index over here. I guess, you know, all markets today are all somewhat tied together. Earlier this month, there was a big drop. I think it's the biggest drop in 3 years in the Hang Seng Index because of the very events going on and the ambiguity of not knowing what's going to happen. Are they going to exit or are they going to work out a deal? So these things do have ripple effects all over the world. And there's been some comparisons too in the greater China stock market, which is a super roller coaster right now. But they've talked about how just in the past 6 months, there's been tremendous growth in the Shanghai index, and they've made more money than the entirety of the Greek debt. So it's, you know, just in 6 months within that market. So they use this Greek crisis as you know, talking points in relation to other markets. The thing I find interesting is I'm almost certain that this same topic was being talked about on the Phileas Club a couple years back, you know, back when you had the old original theme and stuff. And it's like deja vu. It's like they didn't really fix anything then. And it was a big deal, but then it kind of went away for a while. And now here we are a couple of years later, 2015, and it's back again. And it seems mysterious to me because back then it was like this big, huge deal. And they were talking about a lot of these same problems and people were blaming the Greek people and the Greek government. And were they going to leave? Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why people are saying it can't work and it didn't work and it can't work is that the austerity measures that Europe is demanding is asphyxiating the Greek economy, and so it can't start up again and become effective again.
And of course, there's the fact that the country is giving money to Greece, or the Europe giving the money to Greece, also profits from the same money because they are dependent on the military contract deals or exports or stuff like that. So a lot of the money we actually give to Greece is coming back into other European countries at the same time. So don't forget about that.
That is depressing. Well, they found a deal in extremis in the last few hours as these things happened. But for a moment there, it was really like semi-apocalypse. We were hours away from the precipice, really. And the precipice was, if Greek exits, we don't know what's going to happen. And as you were saying, Paul, it affects everyone, not just Europe. And the really troubling thing is that it's going to happen again in a year, or, you know, maybe more, maybe less, but it's going to come back because nothing has changed with this last agreement.
Exactly. Nothing has changed. Nothing is going to change. It's just going to get worse and worse because fixing, increasing taxes, in my opinion, and trying to take care of all of that stuff, that's not the way you solve it. You need to fix the structure of this government, the way things are run, not how much money they collect.
I think, Patrick, you're right about the doomsday aspect, but I think that it's not going to be that bad because you said before that it's been dragging along for so long, this whole process, and everybody has prolonged it for so long that all the important players are actually prepared now. Not completely, but so they're prepared for damage control, I think. So if Greece actually leaves the euro, it won't be that devastating for all important players because they know what's going to happen, that this has to happen at some point. So they have like 5 years to prepare or something. So it's not going to be an apocalyptic day or something.
Mm. Well,
but from Matthias and Patrick, your point of view being in Europe, because there is some discussion and I think there is some fear that if they were to leave, if they were to pull out for better or for worse, that this would have a domino effect. I've seen articles talking about Portugal, for example, being in very similar trouble, though I'm guessing they've kind of somewhat fixed their financial crisis as of last year. But is there a sense that if one goes, then others would start to go and there'd be sort of a domino or a chain effect happening?
That's the fear for sure. The Greek only exiting, I think we could survive without Greece, right? It's not like it was the country that was bringing in the most, financial stability in the Eurozone. But the problem is if one exits, we don't know who else is going to exit. And that means that we don't know how stable the euro currency is. It brings uncertainty. And obviously, as everyone knows, one thing that markets fear most is the lack of stability and uncertainty. So that is a big part of the fear of the Greek exit. Although,
that's
point,
yes. But there's also, we always forget that there are a few economies in Europe that also have similar problems and had those a few years back, but now everybody has forgotten about them. For example, Italy, Spain, Ireland, all those countries had financial problems and economic problems, but everybody is concentrating on Greece right now, and everybody seems to forget, Greece is not the only one.
The obviously the problem is if you're in the Eurozone, you don't control your currency, and so you can't devaluate the currency or do anything, any financial operation that would help you. And so other countries that are having difficulties might want to exit the Eurozone to do that, to be able to control their currency. So yeah,
but I think everybody loses in this whole situation. I mean, for once, of course, Greece, the people in Greece, of course, they're the ones that are hit the hardest. But all the rest of Europe, for example, Germany has now a reputation that rivals the one 100 years ago. Chancellor Merkel and our financial minister Schäuble, they're depicting as the evil dictators now. And
we've heard about this.
Most of all, Europe as a whole is losing, not only because of the economic aspect, but also because it's kind of shaking the foundation of the EU and threatening the European integration. I mean, if Patrick and I would have met like 100 years ago, we wouldn't even thought to do something like a podcast. I mean, we would have probably been taught to despise each other and would have a lingering hate or something, and we would have thought of ourselves as the better man and we are in a superior nation and stuff like that. And now we're living in the longest ever period of peace this continent has ever seen. So, I mean, we have learned that we can work together not only economically, but we can profit from the cooperation on so many levels. And if this is starting to degrade, I feel it's going to be a huge loss for Europe. We don't need the United States of Europe, as Churchill called it, but if we abandon the European project as a whole, we might lose so much more.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. The threat of a chink in the armor of Europe's unity, which has been a source of, many blessings for us in Europe, financial, but not only, we haven't had a feeling. Of course, there are people who don't feel European, but for sure we have a proximity. People travel within Europe. Students go from country to country. We feel very European more than we ever have as a country, I would think. And that could change a little bit if Greece exits. And yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I think I have a solution for all of this. It's just to send Turkey in Greece and tell him to fix everything.
Turkey's going to perform a bailout.
You want me to go to Greece? Have you ever met the Saddam Hussein, president of Iran? All right, that's what would happen to Greece.
All right, so let's not do that. let's move on. I want to talk very quickly before I move on to Turkey's part of the show. I want to talk very quickly about another thing that happened while were away.
What? Oh. How French people are crazy?
Yes, basically. Basically, so taxis versus Uber happened came to a head a few weeks ago when taxi drivers essentially became insane and started pulling out drivers from the Uber Pops service, which is slightly different from Uber period. It's a service that allows normal people to quote-unquote share their drives, basically carpool, but it's in effect a taxi service. It's in a taxi service in everything but name, and it's been deemed illegal, but Uber is fighting it in the courts. And the taxi drivers decided that it was going too slowly, so they started beating up Uber Pop drivers and burning Uber Pop cars. And I was in Finland looking at this, and I could not believe my eyes and ears. And I was thinking, you know, what the hell is happening to my country? They have gone insane, especially since the government didn't really... It's not that they didn't condemn that violence, but they still went ahead and sided with the taxis in trying to push Uber to stop the Uber Pop service,
which they ended up doing. Patrick?
Have you
ever heard something called the French Revolution?
Honestly, we like going on strikes and demonstrations, but I don't think it's ever reached that level. And I don't also I've ever seen that happening and then people acting like it's normal. I'm curious if I was horrified. I was completely horrified, but I'm curious if you guys heard of it or if it didn't reach your shores.
Well, it didn't come here, but we're having a very similar thing go on right now between the local taxis groups and Uber as well. Not to the extent of violence, at least not yet, but I think yesterday there was a demonstration where a group of taxi drivers got together and basically smashed up a taxi cab. Point of demonstration against Uber,
not an Uber car.
They did it to one of their own taxi cabs, but to try and draw press, draw attention, but they are lobbying hard on the government against Uber. And here too, the interesting thing is that wherever I see this kind of argument come up, I look at a lot of the commentary, and a lot of the commentary seems to be the same. It seems to be, all right, if the taxi drivers are so fed up with Uber, they should improve their taxi service. They should improve their customer service, improve their standards to be more competitive rather than taking a lobbying position and simply trying to hold a monopoly on things. And, you know, I'm kind of in agreement to that point. I think competition is a good thing. A lot of people don't like some of the aspects of the taxi service here in Hong Kong because it's
a
universal thing. Yeah. Fortunately it hasn't gotten to the point of violence, but they've talked about, for example, if the government doesn't having protests where they block the roads and doing things like this. So sort of escalation has been on the lips of the taxi side of things. I'm not sure if it'll come to pass, but historically, taxi groups and lorry truck driver groups have formed like a union to do things to sort of hinder traffic when they weren't getting their way with the government. So,
The Uber has been creating these kinds of, the Uber situation has been in this form pretty much in every country in the world. The really surprising thing was that in France, it came to, well, I don't know if it should surprise me, but I assure you it does. It's not something that we usually do. What would happen is that, you know, if agriculture's, farmers are fed up with something, they'll come and burn tires or pour manure in front of Congress or these kinds of things. But burning a car and beating up someone, we've never seen it before. And so the protests are not uncommon anywhere in the world against Uber. But that was, I couldn't comprehend it. I know the situation isn't perfect in Germany either, Matthias. Did you guys hear about that French taxi drivers beating up Uber drivers?
Yes, we heard about that, but I doubt any taxi driver over here would go to those extremes. But then again, if a German looks over to France, they call a lot of things extreme when it comes to labor rights and demonstration and strikes and stuff like that. So
you just look at it and think, oh, that's those crazy French people, whatever.
Yeah, kind of. No, but then again, burning cars in France isn't that novel, is it? I mean, if you, if I remember correctly, in May especially.
Who's typing? I'm hearing typing. Sorry, keep going, Matthias.
Are you hallucinating or something?
Maybe.
Well, there were a lot of burning cars in Strasbourg. For example, Strasbourg.
Yeah, no,
stuff but, like that. So it's nothing new that French people are burning cars. It's just that there are no burning Uber cars.
No, but the thing is, when people burn cars, it's usually fed up youth from the suburbs, and we're not happy about it, and we condemn it very firmly, and we don't go and say, you know, oh, you burned a car. What was it for? Sorry, you got my attention. What did you want again? All right, let's do it.
So
right?
how about kidnapping two managers and putting them as hostage in a factory and blocking the factory with tires? Is that any different?
I would say it's unacceptable as well, but it's not as unacceptable as beating people up, right? I think for me, even for me, I am very French, but even for me, that was, you know, crossing a line.
We're that working was... on it, Patrick. We're converting you slowly. Don't worry.
All right, Turkey.
It's very reminiscent of the old, sort of the old union fights that they used to have in the United States, when there'd be picket lines, and then you'd get these workers to come in and undercut the union wages, and the union's, you know, guys would go in and beat them up. They'd call them scabs and this kind of thing. I think, you know, anytime you have a group of workers who have kind of a hold on an industry, and that shows that there's a lack of competition, and then something comes in to sort of cut into that. And the interesting thing is Uber is more expensive than taxis.
Not in France.
At least here in Hong Kong. Yeah. Okay. So if people are choosing Uber to pay, you know, the slightly higher fare, it's really saying that they prefer some aspect of that service over the local taxi service. So there's a need for improvement.
Yeah. In France, the taxi system is, you know, completely messed up. And I could go into this, but, you know, this is just a side story, so I'm going to move on. But I just want to say that the difference with those union fights that you were mentioning, Paul, is that it is being legislated on right now in France. That specific Uber Pop service has been rendered, you know, has been, there was a law voted back in November that basically said that service is illegal. And it was being decided on in the courts. And Uber just used the legal recourses it was, you know, legally allowed to use to delay the thing. And the court said, well, until we decide, you can keep operating. So there is a legal decision being made. It is being addressed. And it's not that they're being completely ignored. That is the most frustrating thing. There is no good, you know, no way of justifying that rage, in my opinion, justifying those actions by, you know, sometimes you can say, well, you know, when the little guy is being stepped on so much, then they have to rebel and do what they can to survive. It's not even that. They were being listened to. There was a legal proceeding happening, and they just were pissed off that it was too slow, because Uber had started in a couple of additional cities or something like that.
But to be fair, if it wasn't a legal delay, Uber would have just found another way around. I mean, that's how they operate. For example, weren't they going in Israel? They're having the one that is, if you are driving to your work, you can take someone along two times a day or something like that to circumvent the taxi problem and stuff like that. So they are creative enough, so they will find a way eventually.
They're definitely, Uber is definitely super bullish, and sometimes they can even be, you know, asshole-ish to an extent, for sure. But I don't know. Again, I think in a country of law, you have to respect the law, I guess is my conclusion to this. And Uber is crafty, but they're not beating people up and burning cars. And, you know, don't even get me started on the taxes situation, which is also unacceptable. And I think everyone I've spoken to who is in Paris hates taxis, hates taxis. And the irony, and we'll finish on this, the irony is that following these events, the Streisand effect, which basically means that when you try to hide something or destroy something, you bring noise and news about it, and so it becomes more interesting and popular. The Streisand effect made Uber the app the most downloaded app in France for a couple of days. So a lot of people who had never heard of Uber downloaded it and checked it out. So there you go. Systemic issue, and the taxis are at the root of the thing. All right, I could talk about this and how whose fault it is and how it's not the taxi artisans' specific fault, but the big, you know, license hoarders and all of that. But instead of it, let's move on to Turkey and what he has to talk to us about from Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. So what to talk about? Let's see. Well, seriously, the biggest news right now is just the war in Yemen.
I figured, yeah.
Yeah, it's reached a new point where basically the Saudi government with its allies and the recognized government of Yemen have really taken back the second biggest city in the country, Aden, a major port in the country. So that's the biggest news right now. It's about how they are liberated the city and how the efforts of humanitarian aid is moving into the country and so on.
Yeah, that's one that, again, unsurprisingly, is not making a lot of waves here in Paris, at least.
Yeah, this is the number one news. Like, basically, that's what you would read if you go open a newspaper. And keep in mind, I've been actually trying to avoid the news, period. It's been the Eid holidays, so I've been on vacation, trying to relax. I went to Abu Dhabi and trying to ignore the news.
What do you do on vacation in Abu Dhabi?
Abu Dhabi, basically, the only reason, it's a nice place. It's mostly going to the mall.
Oh, right.
Staying at hotels, restaurants, stuff like that. So it's a very nice city. It's clean, it's nice, it's organized. I like it better than Dubai, apparently. Dubai is, let's say, I call it too fake.
How is it too fake?
When you walk around, 80% of the people you meet there are expats. You almost never meet locals. So it's all made up city. It's a city that if a war starts, half of it would be empty in 2 days. Unlike Abu Dhabi, it's more a real city. The majority of people you see on the streets and malls and everywhere are locals. So it feels like a real place that you can actually meet people.
But you just go to malls and you know, I'm wondering if this is a difference in the way we think of what a vacation is. Because if I think, you know, I want to go on a vacation, I'm not going to go to a place where there are malls and restaurants. I want to go to a place where when there's the sun and a beach, I guess you have enough sand and sun at your own place, or a place where I can visit stuff.
Well, basically, in Abu Dhabi, you do have the sun and the beach. So most Europeans go there for the sun and the beach.
Although the beaches weren't very enjoyable.
Well, they're not the best, but they are very nice ones, especially if you go to the ones in the hotels with the resorts. And the problem is that it's 45 degrees in the morning. So that's the biggest problem. And surprisingly, there's European people who are lying down there under the sun, having a tan at 45 degrees and 50 degrees. I don't know how they do it, but apparently they do it.
So basically you look at them and you're like, those people are insane?
Yes, that's exactly what I thought when I saw them, because I don't care. I don't need a tan. I'm just looking for the AC. There's an AC, I'm going. Abu Dhabi has something coming up soon. They have the Louvre. You know that? The Louvre.
Oh, is there a partnership where
they're building a Louvre in Abu Dhabi. It's not ready yet. I think it's going to be open next year, but they're getting there. They have partnership with the Louvre, so it's Abu Dhabi's Louvre museum, so they're going to have a lot of stuff from the Louvre moved there on occasions to be shown.
is going to be shaped like, you know, a copy of the Louvre in Paris, or is
no,
it like
it's a different design. It's a different design. They're okay. taking the basic ideas, but it's a different design. So there's stuff in Abu Dhabi. It wasn't bad. I actually enjoyed it.
Okay. Do you go there often, or is it your like?
No, Abu Dhabi, I think this is only the second time. The first time I hated it, it was 7 years ago. This time I liked it.
Hey, how far is it?
By airplane, it's about an hour and a half.
Okay.
By car, it's about 8 hours drive.
All right.
So it's not that far.
So it's but about it's what airplane. What I thought. I was going to make a fool of myself by saying something like this, but yeah, okay.
I don't need a visa. It's close enough. So I don't even need a passport. I just use my local ID, Saudi ID. So... it's easy to go to and do whatever you need and just at least get away and relax for a few days. So,
all right. A very quick check. How much of the war in Yemen is being reported on in your countries, Paul and Matthias? Let's start with Paul.
Very little.
All right. That's what I thought. Matthias?
Same here. You may find something in a lower setting on a page or something, but not really. Same.
All right. So no one cares. It's terrible.
You're disappointing me, people.
Okay. Just to finish on this, is it now the road to peace, or is it just a step in the right direction?
Well, depends on who you talk to. Officially, it's a step in the right direction. I oppose the war in general, so I really don't care. So,
okay. No, but I mean, it's not like, okay, the war's over, now we're good.
No. Okay, they only took the second biggest city. It's a major port, and still a major part of the country is still under the control of the opposition Houthi movement.
Okay.
And so on. So it's still a big deal. On a second note, another news. This is from the UAE. I don't know if anybody heard about this. Apparently, a lady in Abu Dhabi, an expat, I think she's Australian, was arrested, put in jail, and then deported because she took a photo of a car parked in a handicapped parking, and she did remove the license plate, and then she posted it on Facebook and shamed the owner of the car.
Okay.
And that's why she was arrested and put in jail and deported.
What's the charge for something like this?
The charge of, I'm not sure what's the English word. I think the closest thing that comes to mind immediately, humiliating an individual, exposing an individual or something like that.
That's a crime?
And insulting them. In the UAE, it is. You are not allowed to post anything about an individual without their permission. Just posting it, doesn't matter what it is, you could end up in jail.
Is it because you can't humiliate someone, or?
Yes, it's something like that. So,
you know, I can't remember what our conversation was, but a while ago we were talking about something to that effect and saying how you are, you know, you can be excused if it might have been with Mahmoud, but it would be acceptable to hit someone if they insult your mother or something like that. Like, no one would be, it would still be illegal, but it would be to the around, you know, understood as, well, you know, what did he expect? Is that in the same vein? Like, you can't insult someone and that's it? Like, you can't change someone? No.
It's kind of that. It's just you're not supposed to expose anybody. You have a problem, call the police and report it. If you put it online in public, then you are in trouble.
Okay.
And this is the funny part. We do this in Saudi all the time. It's the
most
normal thing we do, especially people who park wrongly, park in handicapped spots, park taking two parking spots for one car. We post them all over the internet on Twitter. It's a very popular hobby for a lot of Saudis doing it.
Turkey, I don't understand. I thought all of you Arabs were supposed to be the same. It doesn't compute. You're saying you have different habits from different countries?
First, clear something for me. Are you French or are you from Texas?
You caught it. Excellent. Thank you. Oops. All right. Let's move on to...
I'm confused.
Oh, yeah.
by this type of legislation, that means that Turkey technically can't do anything to embarrass you, right, Patrick? Or
well, he's from Saudi Arabia.
I'm in Saudi. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, so unfortunately...
And plus, he is an infidel, so I can do stuff. It's allowed.
Actually, that leads me to an actual question. Is it regarded differently if it's a local or an expat that you're shaming?
No, this one, actually, she shamed an expat, and he complained to the police.
Ah, okay. Well, yeah. So at least it's fair in that regard.
And he was, I think he was European expat, and he complained to the police. He wasn't happy that his photo was online.
Wait, next you're going to say you think he was French? Actually, he was probably from Paris?
Oh, that's a possibility. You never know.
I was actually going someone from Germany who invoked the right to be forgotten or something like that.
There's a lot of people.
The problem with this entire story is she took the photo. However, she removed the license plate. There was nothing identifying him as who he is, and she never even mentioned his name.
So did his name come out in the press in the end because he complained?
No.
Okay.
Never came out. And he complained. Seriously, you're complaining and nobody even knows who you are. and that's going to jail for it.
Terrible. Yeah. All right, Paul, what's been happening in your neck of the world, of the woods of the world?
Oh, well, lots of stuff going on. I think probably the biggest news that most people can relate to in general is this recent announcement from the Chinese government that they're thinking to bring in a two-child policy to tackle what they call the demographic time bomb. So to go back to a little bit of Chinese history, 35 years ago, roughly, they enacted the one-child policy. This was during the Maoist regime as an attempt to try and curb population because China has the biggest population on the planet. It still, despite the one-child policy, continues to have the biggest population on the planet. And they were having issues with starvation and the ability to feed their people, basically. So they came up with this idea. Unfortunately, the one-child policy flies in the face of traditional Chinese culture that was typically very large families and male child dominant families. So this led to decades of a serious issue where families knew they could only have one child or be penalized. So if they had a girl, many of the girls were either murdered as infants, aborted, or abandoned. And this led to issues with orphanages and foreigners coming over and adopting Chinese girl babies. And it's now led to a growing issue where there's a surplus of young men.
They're getting old, right?
And not enough marriageable women. So this is another issue that's just now coming to fruition. So there's this huge surplus of young men who cannot find brides, who cannot find women. This has led to another rash of social issues, kidnappings, and these kinds of stories. And there have been a lot of articles, and there's actually movies made about these kind events, and there's some documentaries that are out there that you can find and that are very insightful. So part of the idea too is that they have an aging population and they have not enough young people to pay taxes into the system, basically, to care for this aging population that's now growing.
That's funny. That's the first thing I went to, and for me that was the issue. I didn't even think about all of the previous ones you mentioned, which are even more, concerning.
Well, see, that's part of the rationale here. And the interesting thing is that they've had a couple pretty bad news stories. There was a news story from 2012 where a woman from one of the Chinese provinces was basically abducted and forced to have an abortion 7 months into her pregnancy. So there's cases of forced abortions. There's cases of
Why would she be forced to have an abortion? Was it her family that knew she was having a girl?
What I remember of the story, it was basically the local family planning office that came in and did it on their authority. And it was a pretty controversial case, and it's one of the cases that is being seen as sparking this move towards a change in the policy. They've been talking about changing the policy for, I want to say, the last 5 years. And now some have speculated that this might go in by the end of the year, but other official statements have said, no, it won't be that fast, but maybe within the next 2 years, they could roll something out. Unfortunately, the idea of a two-child policy is kind of, because the one-child policy is not strictly enforced throughout China. If you are rich and living in the cities like Beijing or Shanghai, there are ways you can get around it, you know, by greasing the wheels, as they say. So you'll find that there are plenty of rich Chinese, Chinese people who have connections to the government, to the party, who've been able to have more than one child. Typically, there's basically a taxation that happens. So if you have a child, they get residence, what they call hukou in China. They can get resident status that gives them access to schools and the medical system and all this. And if you have another child outside of that, then they have a much harder time. You pay a tax penalty as well in some places. Some of the indigenous groups in China, some of the minority groups are exempt from this. So they have some groups who are given special treatment, but for the largest population of the Han Chinese, they're supposed to follow this. There's exceptions too in cases, for example, if the first child has some kind of defect or deficiency, you know, if they're born, I think, with like a Down syndrome or something like this, then you are given clearance to try and have another child. So there are some exceptions to this policy. But for the most part, there are just plenty of horror stories over the years. And for many people, this comes too little too late. So for a lot of people who, you know, followed the law, had one child, and that child, you know, had an accident, has passed away, you know, now the parents are too old to have another child. Whereas, you know, 10, 20 years ago, they could have maybe had two or three kids and they'd still have children living today, kind of a thing. So there are lots of stories like this coming to light as well. And primarily, this is a move being done because they see this, you know, economic imbalance coming in the near future. Some say it's going to be too little too late. China still has the largest population on the planet. You know, it's like at 1.3 billion people. So, you know, take the population of the U.S., which is like, I think, 320 million, and add a billion to that. And that's how many people you still have in China. I know India is the second largest, and they're at 1 billion something. They're just shy of China's population. Yeah. So what does this mean? Does this mean that, again, you're going to see a massive population boom? That's obviously not going to be good when it comes to environmental aspects and things like this. So it's a policy that's being floated out there, and if it comes to pass, a lot of people are not really sure, you know, how good it's going to be and how bad it's going to be. But I think it is one that people are very familiar with, China's one-child policy, and so a change from that will be a pretty big deal, I think, if that happens.
It's, you know, when I read the notes for the show, I was kind of taken aback when I saw two-child policy because, well, we haven't heard about this at all, or, you know, I haven't heard about it at least. And for me, the one-child policy is kind of a legendary thing, you know, a child from the 80s that I am. It's one of the defining things about the communist regime in China. I'm wondering, though, how... Is it, you know, the China's, let's say, interesting brand of communism as it has evolved in the past 20 years, has that had effects on issues like famines and, you know, agriculture, making things easier for the more rural area where the need for the one-child policy isn't as strong as it would have been 30 years ago or 20 years ago?
Well, I think that if you look at the nature of societies, right, if you look at other Asian societies, especially Japan, right, Japan has an issue, a similar issue, right, where they have an aging population and the young people are not having enough babies. You had similar issues a couple decades ago in Singapore, They've also had periods of time in here in Hong Kong where they've, you know, the government's basically gone out and said, have more babies, because of the idea is that when you get a group in the middle class where you have somewhat of a gender equal society and both parents are going out and working and striving to, you know, have careers, there's a bit less emphasis placed on having multiple children. So I think you've seen this happen in Europe. It's happened in the United States, of course, yeah. Whereas you've moved from agrarian societies where you need a lot of kids because of mortality rates and you need help on the farm. And the more help you have, the more, you know, surplus you can have, to where you're moving over to an urban society where that's not a necessity anymore. But as China started out, it's mostly been agrarian. It's only been in the past couple of decades that they've started to move into more and more of an urbanized industrial society. It's still, a very large part of it is agrarian, and so you still have a lot of people out in village rural areas that farm and that have this sort of tie to tradition and the ideas of big families. But you see the middle class and the growing class that have, you know, come to accept the one-child policy, and they've come to accept, you know, the idea of modernity being going out working the 9-to-5 job and, you know, having one kid. This, of course, has led to the phenomenon they call the little emperor syndrome, where because they only have one child, they spoil that child. And now this generation of young people, they call the me generation, has sort of grown up, and they're seen as somewhat vapid, somewhat selfish, and sort of, you know, very into consumerism and not interested in other things. Of course, this is just sort of a very generalized description, of course. I mean, you'll find many young people who are, you know, who volunteer and who are into lots of things, you know, but this has become sort of the general description of the current generation.
I think that that kind of description has reached us as well. We're talking about the me generation in France, I think in the US as well. But I'm sure it's kind of true, but I also cannot remember any time when the previous generation would have said that the next generation is awesome. You know, I can't remember anyone saying, oh yeah, those kids, they're fantastic. They are doing everything right. We think they're perfect, and we did our job to raise them well. You know, Sorry, Matthias?
I was just going to ask Paul if he thinks that this is going to really solve the problem because of that me generation and the new economic growth and stuff like that. Because this problem is one nearly all rich countries do have. And since China's economy has started and is getting more vibrant and stuff like that, do you even think that this generation will want more than two child? Will this actually solve the problem?
It's really hard to say. You know, it's an interesting question to ask, because with the me generation, those who are kind of modernized, they might see children simply as a burden to their lifestyles. You know, I would think that for those who aren't quite there yet, they would, you know, welcome this. They're still having that sort of tie to the traditional idea of a big family. But it could very well take off. But then again, is a population surge in China going to be good for other things beyond sort of the economic forecast as they're playing it out? There's a lot of other issues with China, with things like, you know, food quality and pollution and all these other issues, you know, won't lend itself well to solving those issues either.
All right. You're breaking up a little bit, so I think we're going to move on to Matthias. You wanted to talk about a topic that might please us geeks in the audience, about the end of the ban on video game consoles in China as well. Maybe we can come back to it afterwards. Let me hear if your audio is better.
Is it better now? Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you. All right, let's go quickly over that end of the ban, if you will. Or not.
Okay, yes. So this is a slightly more geeky related No, hello. Can you hear me?
The audio is pretty bad. It's pretty bad, and you're delayed now. I'm gonna cut you off and call you back, Paul. In the meantime, Matthias, please let us know what you wanted to talk about.
Well, I think the most important story around here is kind of a sad one as well, because in Germany we experience a growing, well, movement or whatever you want to call it, of xenophobia or hostility against strangers. And
you mean foreigners or?
Foreigners, yes. Strangers, mm-hmm. Refugees especially, and asylum seekers. And since I think that's a problem for a lot of European countries right now, all the refugees that come over the Mediterranean from Africa, the Middle East, Syria especially, and a lot of them also came to Germany. And, well, a lot of people don't like this, to put it bland. And in the last few weeks or even days, a lot of those housings that are being built for those refugees were actually set on fire. Fortunately, wow. I don't know of any of the people that got hurt, because they were just building those housings. But still, it's a growing movement apparently, and of course, a lot of populists and a lot of politicians chime in and try to use this and are well, trying to please the crowd with slogans that are xenophobic.
So I guess it's accompanied by a rise in the far right parties?
Right, yes. We have a lot of movements, even started last year with the Pegida movement here in Germany, where this became obvious that the xenophobia is growing even more. And since a lot of refugees and asylum seekers are coming now from the Middle East and Africa, it's becoming even a larger problem.
So let me play devil's advocate here for a second and try to understand. So this is pretty clearly bad, but does it come from a place where they are getting a lot of help and there's a large unemployment in the country, so they're getting money that others are not getting? Or is it, has there been violence associated with those refugees, or is anything like that happening? Or is it just pure, you know, evil xenophobia? Not that there's a not evil xenophobia, but you get what I mean.
Yeah, I know. But I think there are a lot of people that are somewhat envious of those refugees, because apparently they get stuff for free, you know? They get all the money and we don't get it. Why? You know? That's completely unfounded, of course, and completely stupid to say that. But it's still some of those people at least might think, and might be a reason for them. But then again, a lot of the right-wing parties just try to use the momentum. And there's this catchphrase, the boat is full, we can't take any more, we have our limits and stuff like that, which is kind of funny, since a lot of the other European countries even take on more refugees than Germany, which is the largest country and one of the richest countries. So
it's, well, I think this has been an issue in the past few months for sure. I think we talked about it a couple of episodes ago in the show as well, and it's been a point of contention in every European country, especially the ones connected to the Mediterranean. But I don't think it's come to a violent event in other countries. And this leads me to another question, which is, it seems that this is not the first time. I mean, in France, we have for sure a far right party, which is the National Front party, which is far right with everything that goes along with the far right parties. But it's become very important. In the last elections, it got something like 15-20% of the votes. So it's not at all insignificant, but it's also become a lot more sanitized than what it was before. So the policies are usually unattainable and somewhat populistic, but they don't go so far as to you know, the leaders of the party, which are now the children of the old leader, and they're actually fighting amongst themselves, but they're trying to make it appear a lot cleaner than it was. So there's no violence, or there hasn't been violent incidents in a long time. There's no racial hatred. There are, you know, they can say things like, we can't welcome any more immigrants because we don't have enough money to pay for this or that. But they're not saying, you know, Arabs smell. Right, they're not saying things like that that we might have heard in the past. And again, there's like no that. Violence, but no. But in the case of Germany, I don't know if that's an impression, but I get the feeling that this is not the first time we're seeing some kind of neo-Nazi faction gaining significant, popularity in the population.
That's true, but with the rise of some new parties, it's actually become a new issue because now those are no longer the dirty right wing you don't want to have contact with, but more the establishment that is now the what's it called? AfD is the name of the party, the Alternative für Deutschland, and the Alternative for Germany.
And usually when you have a name of a party that includes the name of the country, that's a little bit, that's already kind of a sign that there might be something, you know, not right. But anyway, yeah. Keep going.
But that's the establishment now, and they're the academics that are in this party and stuff like that. So that's what's kind of worrying. But again, they're not saying something like you mentioned before, like the Arabs are smelling and stuff like that. That's not the issue, really, but it's also the, they bring in that foreign culture and...
Arabs are not that smelly. There's another nationality they're more smelling.
Well, I've never smelled you, so I don't know.
I'm sure he smells like roses, Matthias. I never have either, but I'm pretty sure
that he got some deodorant in the mall or something while on vacation.
Patrick, you'll get to smell me soon enough. Don't worry.
I'm looking forward to it.
Patrick is going to report on that issue.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually that a lot of people are kind of afraid that the German culture, quote unquote, will get lost because of all the foreigners and they don't want to integrate themselves. Most of those fears are completely unfounded. And also the financial aspect that they get all the money and we don't get that and we don't... they take our jobs and stuff like that are simply not true. And for Germany as well, it's kind of the same problem as we talked about with China. The German population is actually on a decline, so we don't have a lot of children here, and sooner or later we will need a lot of people, skilled personnel to work, and we don't have them, so we have to get them from somewhere. So at some point we need immigration, and a lot of the refugees, especially from the countries where there is war, are often highly skilled and are the ones that actually have enough money to get out of the country. So they could be potentially useful, quote unquote, in the economic sense. So there's actually no need to fear them and stuff like that. But
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm sure there are, you know, not everyone is actually skilled, but there's an interesting parallel to this. I have a friend of a friend who is about 25 years old now, and she's from Afghanistan, but she came to France basically when she was 6 years old. I'm sorry, 6 months old. She's never been to Afghanistan, and she grew up here. She speaks, you know, she's French. But her parents never got the nationality. And now she just finished her studies. She has like a very good degree, and she still cannot get a permanent visa. She's still on a yearly renewable visa, and she's still being under the threat that if she doesn't get her visa renewed, she is going to have to go to back to Afghanistan. She's never been there. She doesn't speak the language. She doesn't know anyone. And it's there is a sentiment that, okay, I'm not being a bleeding heart liberal here, but I can understand that you want to protect your country, or we want to protect our country against people who come here and enjoy the social benefits of everything without contributing anything, and they bring their children and their families and their extended families, and you know, there's this kind of fear of that foreigner that's going to come and eat your bread and take your women. But there's also a point where if the person has been there for, I don't know, over 10 or 15 years, speak the language perfectly, is highly educated, there should be an automatic, maybe not getting the citizenship, but at least you get a permanent visa. You're like, you've been here for your almost entire life, or at least 15, 20 years. You speak the language. You're not an unskilled person that's going to stay on the unemployment benefits and drain the country's resources. I think it's okay to give you to cut you a little slack. And so basically, this is a long-winded way of saying this sentiment is not Germany only, for sure.
Yeah, that's Patrick, true. What would have to say about the Saudis then? We have the same situation here. Here, nobody almost gets a citizenship. And I know some people who were born here that are now 30 years old. They have PhDs and they still can't live in this country. They've never been to their home country.
Well, I guess I would say the same thing, especially for different reasons. I understand that in Saudi Arabia, my image at least, which is still very basic and stereotypical, is that everyone lives off the money of the oil, and not everyone is doing so through merit, and maybe the population is not as educated, and if the oil runs out, there's going to be a systemic economic problem. So I would say it's good to have people who are highly educated and who can make the country run on something else than oil. So for that reason, maybe it's okay to give them the citizenship. But
no, here they have a very good chance of being put on the first airplane to their home country where they've never been, and you can't even speak the language.
Well, I guess it's the same thing.
And there is one other thing in connection with those fires that were late, I talked about earlier. There actually was a map on Google Maps that went public, where there were markers on all the homes for refugees or planned homes for refugees. And that made the round. And, a lot of people said, well, they're using that to plan attacks or to find out where they need to hold their demonstrations and stuff like that. But actually, after a while and public pressure, Google actually took down this map. But that's something that made the news.
So, okay, let me ask you this to bring this conversation to a close. There is a strong xenophobic current. I understand this. Is it being answered to by a strong... You know, how is it regarded to by the general public? Are people outraged? Are people saying, well, you know, whatever, it's crazy kids or crazy whatever, but it's not, you're always going to have extremists? Or how do people react?
There are a lot of people that actually speak out against it. There are also movements and demonstrations against those Pegida movements and stuff like that. Again, a lot of politicians don't speak out against it because then you would frighten all your voters on the right side of the spectrum, you know? And therefore, most of the politicians, of course, speak out against it, especially if it turns to violence, like the fires and stuff like that.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
Then there are some that try to use that momentum just to gain votes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I guess there are people that are speaking out, yes.
And it's fair. Oh, sorry. Finish.
One more thing. There's actually a case that went on, I think, today or yesterday, where Porsche had a trainee that made a racist Facebook comment, and Porsche actually separated and fired him right after he made that comment. So there's that. So at least some companies are also sensitive or don't want the bad publicity in this climate.
Yeah, I think companies would usually react like that in most countries. But the climate you're talking about is definitely, it rings similar to what we're seeing here in France. And with the exception that we don't burn immigrant houses, we just burn the, you know, Uber cars. So I guess all things, yeah, they were more or less equal in that regard. All right, let's bring this show to an end with good news from Paul again with that console thing. This is cool, right? Paul, the console thing, the ban being lifted.
Am I coming in okay?
Yep.
Am I coming in okay? Am I still roboting?
You're not roboting, but I think you're late. So
really quickly. Okay. I'll just make this brief. So back in 2000, China had put a ban on consoles, PlayStations, and Xboxes, and they're now getting ready to lift this ban. So gamers in China can rejoice and, you know, have and play games once again. They originally put the ban in place because they thought games would have a very negative impact on young people. And actually, they do have problems with video game addiction with PC games and online things like MMORPGs. But for whatever reason, they started a pilot last year, and they've decided that they're going to go ahead and lift the ban. I think they just see the economic side of it as being too lucrative to be left out anymore.
So is it a thing where it's purely, you know, is it not corrupting the youth anymore? They decided, all right, that's okay to do because the youth are not corrupted by those video games? Or because that must have been a factor too.
I don't know if they've gone that far into it. They, like I said, they actually have military-style boot camps to deal with video game addiction for online games. So that's an issue. There's actually been a couple documentaries made about that. I just think that they put some restrictions in place. So, for example, PlayStation, Microsoft have to do some aspects of the manufacturing in Shanghai, in some of the, and so some of these devices that are going to be being sold within China have to be made in China. So it seems like they're really pushing for the manufacturing and the economic side of it to be beneficial to them. And that's why I would argue that they just see far too much money to simply, you know, shut their doors to it anymore. You know, the games today make more money than Hollywood movies, usually on first day of release. So I think that there are people in the business who've been lobbying hard to say, we got to get these machines back into China and negative consequences be darned, because there's renminbi to be made.
So basically, yeah, it's corrupting the youth until it puts money in my pocket. And also, it doesn't corrupt the youth, so everyone wins. Woohoo!
Yes.
And that is going to be the conclusion, I think the happy conclusion of this show. That's really good. Everyone wins. And I would like to thank again Turkey, Matthias, and Paul for being on the show. Before we leave, could you please, Turkey, let me know where people can follow you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. My account is Turkey Albella, TurkiAlbella.
You were hesitant about giving your full name before. I'm happy that you're now.
I just gave up. Who cares? I'm done with this. Now, if you understood anything, then let me know.
I understood half of it. So that's not too bad. Matthias.
Yeah, you can also find me on Twitter at Matzekult. Let me spell it out for you. MATZEKULT. And you can also follow me on Google+ if you want to, or use that social network.
Yeah, that's the second part, which is important.
Well, I know you use it, so there's that.
Yeah, I do. That's true. I'll put the link to the Twitter accounts in the show notes anyway. And finally, Paul, thank you so much for being here as well. Can you please let the people know where they can follow you if they wish to?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter. That is Foxlore, Foxlore. You can also find me on Google Plus. And if you have any interest in Hong Kong cinema, Chinese cinema, Asian cinema in general, look us up on our podcast. We are at Kongcast.com, KongCast.com, and the podcast is called East Screen, West Screen.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Paul. So it's Foxlore, Foxlore, and Kongcast. And for myself, it's Patrick Beja on Twitter. No, it's not Patrick on Twitter. You can follow me there if you wish to. You can also find me on my website, which is called FrenchSpin.com. You'll find this show over there, as well as a video game show called Pixels. And I would like, as we close the show, to thank once again the wonderful people on Patreon, the people who decide to support the show financially on Patreon. There's almost 150 of you guys and girls supporting the show and making it possible for it to keep going. I'm incredibly thankful, as always. You know that this show is a show that that isn't necessarily the most commercially easy to put together and to make viable and to make successful. And I don't think it would work if it wasn't for people actually putting their hand to their wallet and sending a little bit of cash our way. So thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for your patience over the past month when we didn't have a show. We are back, and of course, we're back for good. So I hope that you will be there when we come back next month with a new episode of the Phineas Club. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you to the distinguished ladies and gentlemen from the Patreon, and we'll talk to you in a month. Bye, everyone.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.